This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. As we look forward to post-COVID life, the government is also looking towards how to remedy the education shortfall that's happened during the lockdown. Today, £1.4 billion was announced as a recovery fund for education, but it wasn't long before experts in the field said that that wasn't nearly enough. James, how has the day played out?
So the government announced the money this morning, it's £1 billion, but you know that is it is an open secret in Westminster that that was not as much as Kevin Collins, the man brought in to be the kind of government's kind of catch-up czar, wanted. His quote in the press release made clear that he felt that more money would be needed later on, and he this afternoon has just resigned from his job. Now, this is embarrassing for the government. This is the person that they brought in to report personally to the Prime Minister and the Education Secretary on catch up, someone who has a lot of respect in the education world. I think kind of one of those few people who manages kind of to bridge the various highly political divides in the world of schooling in England, and he is gone, and that is obviously difficult for the government. I think what it reveals is this tension we are going to see now, because we're now entering into a new phase of kind of pandemic politics, and education is kind of further ahead than anything else on this, which is how do you clear the backlogs? How do you leave a catch up? Now, there are two tensions playing out here. One is that COVID has obviously taken a big hit to the public finances. And so lots of people in government are like, we have spent huge amounts of money. The kind of Treasury instinctive wish to kind of get public spending back under control kicks in. But then you've got other people saying, we've got to clear these backlogs, and arguing that clearing these backlogs is going to take money. And there's obviously in education, health and the justice systems, those are three big bits of state spending. If you're going to chuck more money at them to solve the problem, where is that going to come from? And so I think what today has given us a taste of is how tricky the politics of backlogs could be for the government.
And Katie, earlier this morning it was Gavin Williamson sent out to bat for the government on the airwaves, and if this row blows up because of the resignation of Kevin Collins, it will probably be Gavin Williamson taking the flak or the criticism as well. But actually it's the Treasury who wants to tighten the purses. You know, is Rishi Sunak behind this?
Well, I think what's been interesting throughout the pandemic is that I think probably the Secretary of State that has received the most criticism about anyone is Gavin Williamson. Matt Hancock, specifically from Dominic Cummings, but I think in terms of general criticism,
15 or 20 times,
it has been Gavin Williamson. And sometimes that's been for things that he hasn't had the final say on. So you look, I think, across the devolved regions, the fact that there are lots of issues in terms of algorithms and grades. It wasn't a specific problem to England and Westminster. And then I think you could criticise Gavin Williamson for not being a strong enough Secretary of State to convince both the Prime Minister and the Chancellor various times to do other things. On the other hand, I think it is the case that the Chancellor is quite keen to bring back a sense of fiscal restraint and to separate emergency spending at the peak of the pandemic from what I think they worry could just be a creep of spending more and getting used to spending more, and ultimately you get into habit of not saying no. So I think that when we're looking at what's happened with this, I think is probably a preview as to the fact that I think there are two main funding rows as we hopefully come out of the pandemic, one on education, one on social care. And the Treasury, perhaps unsurprisingly, given they are the Treasury, so this is their main focus, are pushing back slightly on both when it comes to what ministers number 10 might like to happen. And I think as we go on, it may be more difficult for Rishi Sunak because he has this public perception of being almost a very kind, honest Chancellor. And I think when it comes to these spending rises, if they do start to come back to him, that perception could be challenged.
And James, last night Keir Starmer gave that interview to Piers Morgan that we talked about on the podcast yesterday, and I thought he came across surprisingly well. Here's just some of the things that he said.
There's a big difference between the forensic lawyer and Keir on the football pitch. If I was Keir on the football pitch, I think I'd be chucked out by the speaker. So we've got to be careful about how far we go.
Are you brimming with manly passion?
Always brimming with manly passion.
There's the promo. What's your best physical feature, do you think?
In the end, because it's so talked, I have to get my hair, don't I? I spent my university days in the library.
That's not true.
Studying.
Is it? That's not true.
Studying in the library.
You told me a whopper about being in the library. Am I right in assuming, from your response, that you have tried drugs, but that you didn't actually like them and didn't want to take them anymore?
Piers, we had a good time at university.
What did you make of it, James?
So, I thought in terms of showing a more human, empathetic side to Keir Starmer, it worked quite well, you know. I think it was obviously kind of touching the way he talked about his mother's long illness, how she coped with that, and his difficult relationship with his farm and how he tries to parent his own children differently. When it came to the politics, and he talked about, you know, things that Labour believes in, you know, pride in country, dignity and change. It's all very motherhood and apple pie. You can't imagine anyone saying the opposite of that. But I thought it was a kind of... I don't think it's going to... One swallow doesn't make a summer. It's not going to overnight change people's impressions of Keir Starmer. But I thought it was a reminder that he might not be as kind of politically finished as some of his critics want to make out. I thought it was a kind of relatively fluent performance. And I think with these things, he didn't come across as... I think the danger of politicians in these formats is that they either come across as robotic or they kind of fall into kind of Nick Clegg-style traps. And I thought he managed to reveal enough of himself, but without saying anything that is going to be kind of quoted back at him at PMQs or the like.
No running through fields of wheat moment.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't a kind of tough interview, but I thought he handled the whole thing kind of relatively well.
And Katie, one thing that has been picked up quite a lot is his refusal to say 14 times, ITV says, about whether or not he took drugs at university. Is he a more fun character than people might give him credit for?
I think when it comes to what Keir Starmer got up to or didn't get up to at university, we were certainly left with the impression he wasn't a complete wallflower. He did go out of his room and he wasn't just reading books. But I also thought it was interesting in the interview a few times. At one point, he referenced Nick Clegg. And I think that there is definitely a determination from the Labour leader not to fall into some of the traps of previous politicians when it comes to revealing details about their personal lives. So we left the strong implication that Keir Starmer probably has taken drugs at some point, but he didn't go into specifics. And I think that's probably wise. I mean, in very different circumstances, but we all could see how with Michael Gove, when that claim came out about Michael Gove and use of cocaine, it completely, I think, derailed and really stopped in its tracks lots of things Michael Gove was trying to do. And therefore, I think to go into specifics really risks what Keir Starmer and his team were hoping to be a thoughtful interview to introduce himself to the public. I think if you had one single outlandish claim, and I was noted writing the blend today, when you were saying, well, what was the main takeaway from that interview? It's actually quite hard to pinpoint a single line, but I think it probably benefited from that, because the point is more, they want to say, lots of people switching off on Keir Starmer, they think he's probably a bit of a boring politician, he is perhaps not having that emotional connection. And I think the interview is more about trying to address that and show, I suppose, the human side, which I think it did fairly well in doing.
And the other thing on everyone's minds in Westminster is whether or not June 21st is still going to go ahead. Now, James, you've talked about the various iterations of June 21st. Are any of them more likely than others, reading the tea leaves at the moment?
I think it's probably one of those rare issues where Westminster and the country are obsessed with the same question. I think people want to know whether, you know, when life comes back to normal. I mean, I think the funny thing is, when you speak to people in government, both people who favour a kind of big bang reopening and people who favour a more gradualist approach, they both think that more data will aid their cause. And so I really don't think we are going to see a decision taken until very close to June the 14th, because I mean, both camps think that the closer you get to June the 14th, the more likely the decision is to go in their favour. I would be very surprised if a legal limit on the numbers of people present doesn't go on June the 21st. I think the big question is what happens to things like social distancing, mask guidelines, travel, all of those things. And I think the biggest fight is going to be about this 1 meter rule, because that is probably, of the remaining measures, the one that has the biggest impact, economic impact, because lots of pubs and restaurants can't operate. No pub and restaurant can operate at capacity with this rule in place, and lots of them aren't viable if they can't operate at capacity. But at the same time, it's probably the remaining measure that has the biggest impact on the R number, because once you get rid of the 1 meter rule, you get a lot more contact, a lot more mixing, a lot more mingling. So I think this is probably the biggest argument of it. But I think it's one of those cases where we really do just have to sit and wait for the data. And I think that I think the other thing we're going to find is the data isn't how much we wish it was, isn't coming in perfectly in real time. So yesterday, no deaths announced. Today, 12 deaths announced. The truth is probably that this is a bit of a bank holiday lag. So yesterday's number wasn't as good as it appeared, but today's number isn't as bad as it appears. So I think, however frustrating it is for people who have to wait, you know, whether you're a publican or a restaurateur or someone wanting to go to a big event or have a big event, I think we are just going to have to wait until June 14th.
I mean, Katie, the timings are a bit awkward, aren't they? Because, yes, earlier in the week we had no COVID deaths for the first time since the pandemic started, but everyone says that it takes about 3 weeks for the numbers to feed through, and that's when June 21st is. So the government kind of has to decide before it can actually see if that lag has happened.
Well, I suppose it depends, because if you look at the May unlocking, we're now 2 weeks since that. So I think that you should have an indication as to what effect that unlocking is having before you get to June 21st. And that was partly intended with the 5 week intervals. I suppose a different angle on that is obviously the fact that you now have the Indian variant, which means the government's having to keep a track of that and trying to work out what is the difference between the Indian variant, which initially was in hotspots like Bolton, compared to a general national trend, and two, what is the impact on the Indian variant in terms of its transmissibility on the general picture. But I think there is space in the sense that there are some scientists saying, oh, you want even longer to look at the data, but there also is division within the scientific community. So you have figures such as Sir John Bell, who's been out today saying, actually, things look pretty good, You know, you're on course. And I think when you're listening to the various broadcast programmes, which are at the moment filled with various government advisors on these issues, producers, I think, seem to find it fairly easy to find balance within the government's own advisors. So I think the government is expecting a data report this week and next week. And you should, by that point, expect to start to see trends in terms of the effect of the easing so far, just as you have in the previous sessions.
Katie and James, thanks very much. And do join us again for our next episode. If you enjoyed this episode, rate and review us and tell a friend about it too. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time.